Thank you. Be seated.
Court will hear argument in the consolidated mandamuses of N. Ray Masonite. Hey, if we go to Hankinson, Justice Hankinson is not sitting.
May it please the Court, James Maloney will present an argument. Later, have reserved 5 minutes for
May it please the Court. Initially, if I could, let me quickly set the stage. This court has consolidated two cases of argument. One, the Arredondo case, was originally composed of 419 plaintiffs. We filed suit in Jim Hogg County, of which 352 were admittedly not residents of that county. The other case, Adams, was composed of 223 plaintiffs, again 158 admittedly not residents of Duval County. In response, these defendants were later to file appropriate motions to transfer the non-resident plaintiffs' cases, in each case to Dallas County, a county of unquestioned propriety, but never challenged, never specifically denied. In response, the plaintiffs amended their petitions, admitted the impropriety of their initial choice of venue, moved to sever, and to transfer to the counties of the non-resident plaintiffs' residences. At the hearings on February 10th and February 26th, the respondent, Judge Garcia, sitting in each of Jim Hogg and Duval, on his own motion, as is clearly reflected in the orders, as well as in the transcripts of the hearings which have been provided to the court, transferred each of the non-resident plaintiffs' cases not to Dallas County, the county designated by the defendants, but instead to their home counties. In total, 510 plaintiffs, 14 different counties, not a county, original counties. I believe the law is absolutely clear. The trial court had no authority, statutory or otherwise, to transfer to any county other than that specified by the defendants.
Okay. Or the response from Mr. McMahon is that that's not what the authority says. The authority just simply says if it's not the county where it is, not the proper county, then it shall be transferred to a county that is a proper county. There's nothing there that says only to where the defendant says.
I think that section 15063, which is the section which Mr. McMahon points, which reads, quote, shall transfer an action to another county of proper venue, has to be read in conjunction with this court's rules of civil procedure. 86 and 87. Any reading of those rules clearly states that the plaintiff gets the first choice, but upon proper challenge and upon denial of that venue, if the defendant then comes forth and designates a county of proper venue, then the court only has those two choices. In fact, if the court looks at, I think it's 87D3, which is the rule on the hearing, the rule makes it clear that the court can hear additional evidence either on the plaintiff's choice of county or the defendant's. There is not a third option.
What about his argument that the statute trumps the rule?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the statute can be read other than in conjunction with the rule. That's the proper mechanism by the reason.
Well, the statute
moreover, I think
first, and then we pass the rule, but the statute says anything in the rule that's
right. But the statute does not say, Your Honor, any other county of proper venue. It says any county of proper venue, and of course the only other designated in the rules or in the statute is that county designated by the defendants, and that of course is consistent with the case law. And this court itself, Wilson versus Texas Parks and Wildlife, said that if the plaintiff fails to meet his burden to establish venue in the county of suit, the trial court must transfer the lawsuit to another specified county of proper venue, and if you look at footnote 1 to that opinion, that is the county designated by the defendant. And the other cases are in accord, Tenneco versus Salyer, Miranda Temple, and all of those cases cited, I think, in footnote 5 to our question. So I think it's clear that he did not have more than discretion to simply pick a county.
So it's an abuse of discretion?
No, Your Honor. That order is void. He had no authority.
But there's a lot of cases that say to the contrary.
I think that the better reason for it certainly is that a court which on its own motion transfers to a county other than that designated by the defendant or the plaintiff, that order is void. And mandamus.
Well, can't you make the argument about whatever the trial court did, he didn't follow guiding rules and principles, which are the arguments that you're making exist. That is, that the statutes say you can't do that. But he did have jurisdiction of both the parties and the subject matter.
Absolutely. No one is contesting that. What he didn't have jurisdiction to do was to issue this order. He had no statutory or other authority to issue this order. He just grabbed a county. You know, and if you look at that,
the rule requires a party with making your type of motion to specify another county.
Yes, sir.
What language in the rule says that that's all the trial judge can consider?
I think if you look at 87D3, is that section here, Mr. Roman?
Let me see if I can pull it up.
Actually, 87D3D. In the event that the party shall fail to make prima facie proof that the county of suit or the specific county to which transfer is sought is a county of proper venue, then the court may direct the parties to make further proof. Those are the only two options, the county of suit or the designated county. And that has been the law for 100 years. And to get to your point, Justice Becker, if you look at the precedential value of this, what we have is a trial on its own motion, picking a county, admittedly a county that initially might have been a county of proper venue, and transferring a case. Do we want the trial courts of this state to do that? Or do we want them limited as they are presently limited by the statute and by the rules?
Well, let's say we don't want them doing that, but they just exceed the statutory scheme, which you say is void, and it's an abuse of discretion. Or you say it doesn't matter whether you abuse his discretion or not, it's just flat void, so that's why we're going to say we can have mandate.
Right. I think, you know, Your Honor, you can either take the void approach or you can take the void of any basis in law, a separate approach.
Well, under Walker versus Packer,
yes,
we've clearly said that to improperly apply the law, the trial court has no discretion, and accordingly, it's an abuse of discretion if you don't do so. Why doesn't that facet of mandamus practice apply in this case?
Well, I think that in this case, the Dyckman case rules, and that is where you have a void order.
Well, but that presumes there's a void order to start with.
It does, sir.
And so,
why? Then you're asking me, why is it that I don't have an appropriate appellate remedy?
Well, that's my next question.
You want me to answer that one?
Yes.
What we have now is we have 510 cases. Excuse me, 510 claims. 14 different counties. Now, even if you assume that we could try all those plaintiffs' cases in 14 courts before 14 juries, we have wasted 14 courts and 14 juries' time. Now, there is no way we can try one case involving 352 plaintiffs at one time. So I think it's easy to assume that there are going to be dozens of trials.
But wait a second. Wouldn't that be the situation if all these cases had been filed in the originally proper venue? You would be stuck trying a whole bunch of cases in a whole bunch of counties.
We would, Your Honor. We would, Your Honor, but they lost that option.
But
as a matter of law, they lost that option. By choosing the counties they did, they don't get a second bite. The applicant, of course, they tried to take one, and that makes this situation even more egregious. What the trial court did, albeit on its own motion, was take the suggestion of the plaintiffs and send them back to the residence counties where they couldn't have filed originally. But they didn't. They also could have all filed in Dallas County. Every one of them, which would have made everyone's life much easier. But on the appellate remedy,
well,
we
maybe
now have
the plaintiffs wouldn't agree that that makes everyone's life easier to be in Dallas County.
No, Your Honor, I understand that.
But you still have the problem, even if you're in Dallas County, you're going to try
a
horrendous number of cases.
Absolutely.
But it'll be a whole lot more convenient for your clients because that's where their home office is.
Well, and it's also the place
Let's take a slight step back. Let's assume that the trial judge clearly, unequivocally, violated the venue statutes.
Yes.
And violated the venue rules of civil procedure. You're saying that that makes the court's order void.
Yes, sir.
My question is, why would that not be the case in every situation where a judge is ruling is contrary to the clear wording of the statute or the clear wording of the rule.
Well, this is not, you know,
we have that occur all the time, frankly.
Well, I understand.
And we're not saying that all those rulings of trial courts are void.
I understand the question. And I think this is a different situation than one in which a court simply makes a mistake. You know, this is one in which the court had no authority to act.
Let me finish on this. He had no authority to act because he acted contrary to what the statute says.
Well, that's true.
And if that's the case, then literally almost on a weekly basis, we have situations where trial judges make rulings that are contrary to statutes, and arguably by extension, all those rulings are void.
Well, we also have, in addition to the rules of the statute, Your Honor, we do have a well-developed case addressing exactly this type of issue that holds, you know, whether it be Robertson versus Gregory, the city of LaGrange, and in many cases that were brought up, have held orders transferring venue on courts on motion to be heard. That even in cases where someone else has initiated the motion to transfer is appropriate, where the court picked up the ball and ran with it himself or herself.
May I ask you a question? I'm just a little confused. Your opening statement indicated that when the plaintiffs felt they were in some trouble, they filed a motion asking that all of the non-Jim Hall County residents be sent back to their home county.
They entitled the motion to separate, yes, but the relief sought was the movement.
A venue transfer.
Yes. And that, of course, is improper.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but your next statement is, but then the trial court did what they asked, but quote, on his own motion.
He did.
Now, how does that happen when you have a pending motion saying, do this for us?
Well, this court specifically said he was not granting the defendant's motion, he was not granting the plaintiff's motion, he was on his own motion.
The Court of Appeals said that.
Well, so did the court in the transfer, the lower court.
Trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, let me ask you, let's assume you went through a trial and you won in all these 14 different counties. Would you then say that the judgment, the take nothing judgment in his favor was void because the trial court had no jurisdiction?
I think that we have built reversible error into this case.
No, I'm not saying reversible error. You win.
I win, but I might, you know.
And then can the plaintiff come back and say that that judgment, that take nothing judgment in your favor is void because the trial court never had jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor, but I think what the plaintiff's lawyer could say is that transfer was void.
So he could try it.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, there is automatic reversal built into all of these cases.
Even you don't think it can be waived. You don't think that the trial court's error in transferring to these 14 counties could be waived by you or by the plaintiff. If you try
it. Well, I certainly think it could be waived.
If it's waived, then how can it be void? If it's waivable, how can it be void?
Well, I think that, you know, as with any judgment, you know, if you choose not to challenge, you can waive the challenge.
Well, void means it's a nullity, and so it's not something that you can waive.
Subject to a collateral attack in any court.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's an interesting question. I would think, though, it would always be up to the litigants to decide whether they wanted to live with that result or not before they, you know, try to challenge. But that's really the best response.
Somewhat along those lines, regardless of whether what the trial judge did is void or voidable, in fact, let's assume that it was voidable, under the circumstances of this case involving a transfer of venue,
yes,
as opposed to some other voidable action by a trial judge, is there valid jurisdiction vested into the transferee court? In other words, do all these transferee courts have valid jurisdiction, even if the order is voidable?
The order is void.
No.
If it's voidable?
If it's void, I'm going to presume they don't have jurisdiction. Let's assume it's voidable.
And that is a very good question. I've not considered it.
Let me ask you this.
I would like
supplemental briefing after oral arguments, if you all don't mind, on the answer about whether or not, if what the trial judge did is voidable, if there is a lack of jurisdiction in the transferring courts.
We will get you that, Your Honor. We've touched upon the adequacy of the appeal. I think the Dykeman back to you, I'm sorry.
But the inadequacy of appeal is based upon the argument that the order is void.
Well, it's also...
What if it's just a voidable order?
No, I don't believe we have an adequate remedy on appeal.
Because
I think if you look at your CSR decision, I mean, we fall right within that decision. I mean, we're talking about an enormous waste of judicial time, of jury's time, of litigants' time, lawyers' time.
But that was just one factor in CSR.
Yes, and we're also looking at the same time that the other, another factor that's mentioned by this court is, of course, the pressure of the settlement. We're going to have to try hundreds of cases in different locations. And that, of course, increases pressure. So when we certainly don't believe any of these cases have any merit. Now, these are all summary judgment material.
Well, then
limitations
you,
ran
you can file 16 different motions for summary judgment, and it's all over pretty fast.
It wouldn't be assuming that, of course, all things might wait on it. That's not always been the case.
Well, I understand that, too. I'm just responding to your argument that that's why there's a massive amount of time and effort and lawyer and client money. But if they're all summary judgment cases, you can file those pretty rapidly under 166A.
Right. But if you assume that any fact question is raised, then you assume it's not going to be simply 14 cases, 14 years. Because there is, as I said, no way we can try one case with 352 plaintiffs. There are different claims, different numbers, those are different times, different levels of
money. Well, was there just one petition filed with however many plaintiffs there
two.
Were?
Yes, Your Honor.
Two petitions in two different counties, totaling 510
no,
plaintiffs.
700.
Plus
710
were non. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Russell McMain will present argument for the response.
May it please the court, as already announced, I'm Russell McMain's co-counsel for the respondents in the two consolidated cases, which I think basically present the same issue, which principally is this order subject to being mandated? That, I believe, is the crucial issue that is before the court. The standard principles of mandamus that this court articulated in Your Honor Justice Phillips in Walker versus Packard, which the court has relied upon frequently since, recognize that generally, even if a trial court makes a mistake, an error of law, which constitutes an abuse of discretion, and however one wishes to characterize that, whether it's voidable or legally erroneous or whatever, that these are incidental rulings that are not subject to review by mandamus unless there is no adequate remedy by appeal. In order to avoid that effort, the suggestion was made that the trial court's authority or the trial court's order in this case is, quote, void. Basically, what he is suggesting is that every time there is an erroneous venue decision, that it is mandamusable, and this court has held quite to the contrary, as has the legislature in the statute that they passed. The statute specifically authorizes mandamus only in the event of mandatory venue. That's the only time that the statute suggests that mandamus is appropriate.
Well, it also provides a right of interlocutory appeal for most cases.
No, Your Honor, not for most cases. Only for the situation as held by the San Antonio Court, and I think supported by the San Antonio Court's analysis of the legislative history, with regards to the Polaris situation, that is, people who come in later. In regards to decisions on intervention and decisions on joinder at a later time, those are the only things that are subject to an interlocutory appeal, which has some very rigorous rights. It was specifically crafted to deal with the Polaris situation. It is not designed to deal with a situation simply where there is more than one party that files a lawsuit in the same lawsuit and the initial joint. That is not what the function of that statute was, as appropriately held by the San Antonio Court of Appeals. It is the purpose of the statute when it was originally changed in 1983, and we don't have 100 years of jurisprudence on the question of proper venue. We had 100 years of jurisprudence on the question of police privilege, which the court was fed up with. And that's why Justice Pope went to the legislature with regards to making the alterations that ultimately came into the statute in what used to be the old Sections 15, and now is in Chapter 15 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code as they've been changed after Torquay to embrace more protections for defendants with regards to their venue assertions, but not to the point of saying and not undoing what was one of the principal concerns of Justice Pope was that there is a lot of unnecessary appellate activity in the venue area. That's precisely the reason that the statute precisely provides that it is not subject to being appealed. And the trade-off for that is that there is presumptive reversible error in the event that there is an improper venue trial. And that's for the person, obviously, who is asserted. Now, that is what the statute trade-off basically is. And it's to say that we're not going to saddle a person on a venue issue with a harmless error principle.
I presume you're going to be of the opinion that regardless of the error of the trial court's ways in transferring these cases to the counties that it did transfer them to, the counties to which these cases got transferred to, the courts to which they got transferred to, have jurisdiction.
Yes, sir.
Tell me why that's your position.
It's my position for the simple reason that if the trial judge making an error of law does not deprive a subsequent judge from subject matter or party jurisdiction.
Well, let me take a hard case. Say the trial judge is just sitting there, calls everybody in, and says, I've been thinking about this, and I'm just going to try to transfer this case to Jefferson County. Plaintiffs say, well, we object to that, Your Honor. Defendants say, well, we do too. This Jefferson County doesn't have anything to do with this. It couldn't have been brought to Jefferson County. Why are you going to do this? Well, I know I don't have any statutory authority. I know I don't have any real authority. But I know you can't mandamus me, so you're off to Beaumont and have a good time. Is mandamus not mine in those circumstances?
Your Honor, there is a difference in terms of Humphreys and some of those cases which talk about, and again, this court in MAPCO pretty well laid out the notion that if a court has the power to act as a court, and if the court has subject matter jurisdiction, and they have jurisdiction over the parties, what the court does that's legally erroneous or not in compliance with statutes does not render the order void. Now, in the context that Your Honor has presented, the suggestion is that there nobody sought any kind of a transfer. And given the fact that the Texas Wildlife case, Wilson versus the Texas Parks case, the court was actually attempting to enforce what the plaintiffs had bargained for in the 1983 changes, which was, we have the right to retain the case in a county that we file if we make the proof properly. And the judge doesn't have the power to transfer it. And that's all that Wilson recognized, is that that right shall be enforced through an appeal. Through an appeal, basically. It's not a mandamus.
So in my situation, you wouldn't have mandamus.
And you mean in the situation where it's just automatically done?
Yeah, well, the hypothetical...
Wilson is an appeal, of course.
Right, but I...
And I don't think they have mandamus jurisdiction in it, for if it's the plaintiff either. If I file in a proper county, and the trial court transfers me anyway, for whatever reason.
Without a motion.
Without a motion or with a motion. He's still wrong. If it's a proper county that I file in and Wilson says I get reversal.
There's wrong and there's
but
wrong.
But it wouldn't authorize me to seek mandamus.
Was there any county in Texas, any district court in Texas, where it would be void for that court to hear, regardless of the venue? Where it would be void for that court to hear it.
Your Honor, frankly, I think that the entire issue of does the transferee court assume jurisdiction over the case that's been transferred, assuming that it was erroneously transferred, which I think is basically the assumption, however it is determined to be that it was erroneously transferred, it is interesting to note that the legislature has provided a system in Chapter 15 now, which specifically authorizes a transfer for convenience of the parties when that county is proper county to any other proper county.
But that, Justice, and the hypothetical is an end of a county with no venue. It's clear there's no venue. Now, is that a void judgment?
Transfer it to a county with no proper venue?
That Jefferson County in his hypothetical would have improper venue.
Well, I believe that transferring it to a county of improper venue is erroneous, but no, I do not think that it's void.
And it's not mandamus.
I do not think that it's mandamus. I think that it's void. I mean, I
you
think
agree
that it's.
That,
I think it's erroneous, voidable in the sense that it is not in compliance with statutes. But I don't think that that renders it void in and of itself.
Why do you conclude that that order, even if it's not void, is not
mandamus. What is the basis for saying that an order entered under
Well, this court has, this court's frequently said that you must, again, in Walker versus Packer, and a litany of cases that are cited in Walker versus Packer, that is part and parcel of the mandamus jurisdiction being an equitable remedy, is the necessity that there is no adequate remedy at law, and in the case of the mandamus context, usually talked about in terms of no adequate remedy by appeal.
But isn't
and the mere fact that it will cost more money or be more inconvenient in some cases does not in any way impede the appellate rights according to this court's general
decision. But aren't
decisions.
There circumstances, aren't there, hadn't this court always said in relation to many mandamus cases that there could be extraordinary circumstances involved in a given case where ordinarily the court would not entertain mandamus, but under the facts of these cases they would, and it's not clearly that it's not protectable on appeal. It could be protectable on appeal, but the circumstances are so extraordinary that mandamus is merited.
Your Honor, we attempted to deal with all those exceptions, none of which, of course, apply in this case in terms of any precedent this court has ever used in the past. But this court, once it opens the door to say that an adequate remedy by appeal is no longer a prerequisite in mandamus, has no way to shut the door. Because basically...
So you say National Sand was just not an example of an extraordinary circumstance?
I'm not suggesting that there aren't exceptional circumstances, especially in the civil appearance and the requirement to be in the court in the first place. Those kinds of exceptional contexts, right to due process with regards to notices, things that this court has taken exceptional issues with, things that go directly to the heart of being able to establish the merits in the first place, I don't think this impedes the merits at all. I can't disagree more with my opposing counsel when he suggests that we would have any right at all to complain about take-nothing judgment entered in the transferee courts in this case. Absolutely would have no right, no basis whatsoever for doing so.
Let's assume that this is not void. Go to the merits here. In order for your view to prevail eventually, either here or on appeal, does our Wilson footnote have to be wrong?
No, Your Honor, not necessarily, because that's not to say that the rules aren't designed in the idea that basically there is a first choice. Incidentally, if I may make one correction before I forget it, as I undoubtedly will, there was not only one choice of venue in this case, despite what has been suggested by the other side in its briefing and otherwise. There were three defendants that filed three motions to transfer to three different counties. And one of the things that was accomplished in the 83 statute was the unitary notion of causes, in the sense that cause of action by a single plaintiff against multiple defendants should all go to one county. And one of the discretions that is vested with the court is to send it to any of the proper counties. The idea that it could only sever and send part of the case was exactly what the court was trying to avoid when they proposed to the legislature that these things be changed. They did not like the fact that the cases were being split up. So that the court did not have only one decision to make, which Johnson versus the Fourth Court holds is really the requisite for mandamus. It had any number of decisions to make, even if the idea that it had to go to one of the ones requested by the plaintiff, by the defendants, there were three. It had a choice. It does not have a right to go to Dallas. There is not only one decision without invading the court's discretion in this case, which is another reason why mandamus is simply inappropriate.
Do you agree that the court acted on its own motion?
That is what the court said, Your Honor. I mean, that's what it says on the record, and I think that's what it says, in fact, in the order, that the court says on his own motion that he did so. Now, let me explain this. By personal opinion, there were motions to transfer for convenience of the parties that were made by the defendants, or one of the defendants, not all of the defendants, but one of the defendants in each of the cases made a motion to transfer for convenience of the parties. That is a fairly new, well, it's a completely new practice in terms of having any law on it, and it should be, because the simple fact is that the statute itself says that it's not subject to appeal or mandamus or complaining, being complained about.
Isn't that irrelevant, though, because doesn't the order say that it's a motion to transfer a venue on the court's own motion?
And well, it does not in those terms. It just says, came on to be heard these motions, and it lists a bunch of motions that are filed by the defendant, and included in those is the motion to transfer for convenience. And then the court says, on my own motion, I'm transferring it here. That it is true that he says that. But it is also true that he is ruling on motions that are brought into issue by all of the parties. And the complaint that was made by the other side was that at the trial, at the particular venue hearing, was that you can't send it to where the plaintiff's request. And that's why the judge basically said, well, I'll send it to where I think it ought to be. But the point remains that, and in answer to Your Honor's question, which I unfortunately put off, the question of ultimately to prevail, must I disagree? The issue of reversible error in the venue determination is one made at the end of the trial on the basis of the complete record. I am not suggesting to you that there is any venue basis at the present time on the present record. We also haven't had a trial. The issue of reversible error, however, is one that is determined on the entirety of the record.
But this point's not going to change, I don't think.
It might.
Let's take a case where the defendant's not, where there aren't different defendants asking it to be scattered to the winds, but just a case where there's a simple, you filed it in Duval or Newell or whatever, and there's a motion to take it to Dallas.
Yes.
And the judge sends it to Kim someplace.
I think that's correct.
Wasn't the judge confined to one of those two counties, the one where it is right now or where it's being...
Assuming there was evidence that it was a proper county, I think Your Honor is correct.
And so...
Under the Wilson footnote,
So if the Wilson footnote's right, that's going to be reversible error. The appellate court doesn't look at the whole trial and say, well, this was a great trial, and they got a good jury in quickly, and so it's okay. It's reversible error.
I understand that, but of course, as already pointed out, the defendants may win, in which case it's not going to be an issue.
I'm talking about your holding a verdict in the long run. Doesn't Wilson have to be wrong?
And, well...
I mean, you say the rule conflicts with the statute. Either the rule doesn't say can't be read as tightly as they read it, or if you can, or if you do read it that way, it conflicts with the statute, and therefore it falls under the 1995 amendment.
Wilson, of course, is not a defendant's case. It's a plaintiff's case, in the sense that it is the plaintiff who filed it in the proper county, and it was erroneously transferred. And the Supreme Court specifically said that it should be kept, that having transferred it, that transfer was improper and therefore reversible error. And I really believe that the court did that in order to avoid the very question of whether or not mandamus might be the only remedy to a plaintiff who is transferred. Because otherwise, the statute simply says it's presumptively reversible error if it's not tried, if it's tried in an improper county. And so what the court did was basically say, no, you do have these remedies, even if it is transferred to what is otherwise a proper county, but it is done improperly, then it may still be presumptively reversible error. Now, the question, as Your Honor poses, in regards to voidability, the question now comes, the statute specifically says you can transfer anywhere by consent of the parties. Suppose we agree to go, and one or more of the parties agree to go to another county from the county that it has been transferred. There is simply no basis in the world to suggest that transfer to the third county would ever be any error or any impropriety whatsoever. So is there reason for the court not to immediately intervene and mandate the situation yet in the context of ancillary matters? I don't think there's any place to draw the line. What's the difference between this and a plea and abatement in Abreu versus Black in terms of dominant jurisdiction? And the overruling of a plea and abatement when a prior suit is filed earlier in one. The court says, we're not going to mandamus. Not a good idea. You shouldn't do that. But we're not going to mandamus in that particular context. It's clearly erroneous. It's clearly inconsistent with rules and decisions by this court. It clearly builds in reversible error should it carry forward that way. And yet the court chose not to mandamus.
I've listened as hard as I could, and I don't see an answer to question about Wilson. So while you're answering Judge Abbott's question.
The answer to your question simply is, if the dicta in Wilson is correct, that is that he had to transfer it to either Dallas, Tarrant County, or San Antonio, and he didn't do that, then it's reversible error if we try the case in the counties he did transfer it to.
Okay, so
your Honor's question, however, assumes that that is what we're going to try the cases. And what I'm saying is, but your Honor, what I'm saying is that the point of the difference between a choice of mandamus, which is immediate intervention, and a choice of waiting until the record is closed, which is the choice made in terms of the reversible error determination in the venue statute, is an intentional choice. The reason for limiting the nature of what can be appealed in terms of joinder in intervention decisions, not venue decisions and not transfer decisions, but joinder in intervention decisions only after the initial filing, and mandamus in terms of mandatory.
Even the Court of Appeals can read the statute that narrowly. For example, in this case, if the trial court had denied to any relief at all, I think it's pretty clear that the defendant has an interlocutory appeal. I take it you don't disagree with that.
Then I do disagree with that. I don't believe the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals didn't have to reach the issue.
The statute joins as two different conjunctive phrases, which makes it pretty clear to me it's talking about a multitude of plaintiffs, some of which do not have proper venue.
The legislative history of that statute is very clear that it was designed to deal with Polaris. That's the legislative history that is relied upon by the Court of Appeals.
Isn't this kind of an unusual situation that just really fell through the crack in the interlocutory appeal statute?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't believe it. Otherwise, what Your Honor is saying is that every time there's more than one party to a lawsuit, there's a right of interlocutory appeal in the venue statute, the venue determination. If that's true, then what the legislature did in 1995 was to basically wipe out 12 years of jurisprudence under what they had done in 1983.
They said joinder or intervention, so they must have meant something other than later filing plaintiffs.
Well, a joinder or intervention is simply by amending a pleading to add people is a joinder. And intervention is what it is under the rules. And that's what it's always been. Joinder does not mean I file a petition that has more than one party. If it does, then there's a right to interlocutory venue appeal, and this court, the courts of appeals, will be cluttered with venue appeals, because there is very seldom a lawsuit filed that doesn't have more than one party in it. It's not venue determinations; it's the propriety of the joinder or intervention decisions, and not a venue issue that is at issue in those cases.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
If this is really voidable and not void, do you have a right to mandamus relief?
Do I?
If this is merely if this order is merely voidable, then do you?
I believe I do, Your Honor, under this court's cases, the Deloitte case, the National Sand case. And this order is so devoid, you know, of any basis in law that mandamus should, in fact, be applicable here or available.
Well,
excuse me.
Well, you're saying it's an abuse of discretion, but that's only half of what you look at when you're talking about a mandamus proceeding.
Well, but then under the Dyckman line of cases, and I know that this court in Walker versus Packer, and subsequently in Gary, said it really has not decided whether or not Dyckman still stands, but the court has applied the Dyckman reason a number of occasions without mentioning it specifically, and I would direct the court's attentions to the NRA Union Pacific Resources. This is a judge continuing to sit in violation of a constitutional prescription, mandamus lay. Dunn versus Street, Mitchell Energy versus Ashford. And then, of course, we have Ryan and Zimmerman, the cases in which the Court of Appeals has held or acknowledged this exception to Walker and to the general rule that you need to have an adequate remedy of appeal. So I do think there is substantial authority out there that mandamus will lie, whether this is a void order or one devoid of any basis in law. I mean, and you could go either way. I think this fits those facts. You know, this was a court, you know, following, for example, the MAPCO line of cases, moving back one from MAPCO to Browning versus Platt. You know, there the language was jurisdiction to enter the particular order. This court did not have jurisdiction to enter the this order. He had jurisdiction over the parties, over the subject matter, but nothing in the statutes, nothing in the case law gave him jurisdiction to do what he did. That was simply plug these cases up and send them on. We never knew it. Well, that is, I think, a very bad precedent.
Trial courts have jurisdiction to enter all kinds of orders. They just don't have the power to abuse the discretion when it departs from the statute or the rule. And it seems to me that jurisdiction and authority are two different things here.
I think
when I listen to your argument, it sounds like, well, we've got three parts to jurisdiction now. We've got subject matter, personal jurisdiction, and then this netherworld of, well, you really went too far, so we're going to say it's void.
But I think that is consistent with these court's earlier decisions. If you look back at the way that the MAFCO language was stated earlier, Browning versus Black and its predecessors, I think, you know, I'm kind of guessing, in Cooper, or Cook, there's a case even earlier than Browning versus Black on what is void and what is voidable. The language is very clear. They look at jurisdiction of the person, the subject matter, jurisdiction entered a particular order. It is a separate thing. And I think that is applicable here. But I think you also can take comfort in reaching down and grabbing this case from that line of cases in which this court has found those actions to be so devoid of any basis in law, that they should be remedied and are available for remedy by that basis. I was going to, on this court's point on footnote one, I think, yes, I mean, footnote one is going to be rendered meaningless if this court says, any trial court can simply pick any jurisdiction that might initially have been appropriate, but was not initially chosen by the plaintiff or the defendant to send a case to. And then, if the only remedy is appeal, you know, there potentially could be a lot of appeals. I think it better if this court correct this at this juncture, because I think it's a very damaging precedent going forward. And unless you have some questions, I'll sit down.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the oral arguments in the foregoing clauses, and they'll all be submitted on briefs and oral arguments.